So I thought I'd share with you, this is just a funny little thing that I wrote, and I just gave it to my husband. It's not, you know, a book or anything or published. It's short. It's a little rhyme about dinner time, okay? And it's supposed to be from the older son's perspective. Okay, I called it Supper in the Morning. Mom was in the kitchen cooking up a meal when she hollered out to me, "Jack, please come here. Get the plates and the cups and 5 forks and spoons. Please set the table because supper will be soon." Mom's eyes had tears as she held an onion peel. Then my two little brothers started to squeal. They squealed and they squawked and they fell to the ground. "I'm trying to cook," Mom said. "Please stop that sound." They raced and they roared through the house on their bikes, crashing into Mom's ankles. She shouted, "Yikes!" Sam fell off his bike and he screamed, "I need ice!" Mom ran to the fridge but slipped on some dice. "Pick up your toys," she yelled with fists to the sky. Then the phone rang. It was Dad on the line. "Dad will be late," I announced to the crew, "and I almost forgot my school project is due." Then I practiced piano. It was Bach number 3. The song was quite hard. It was brand new to me. Then Timmy, who's 2, climbed up on the bench, and he banged on the keys with his little toy wrench. When I told him to stop, he reached for my face. He tore off my glasses. A lens popped out of place. I couldn't see clearly, but I heard Mom mutter, "Witching hour is here," she said with a stutter. I peered through one lens to watch a strange scene. It was 5 o'clock sharp, and Mom turned all green. The green was not dark, it was pale and light. Her nose grew a wart. What a terrible sight. She stirred up her rice, or was it a stew? Her spoon was a wand in a big witch's brew. Was this witching hour? It must be the case. Deep wrinkles took over Mom's beautiful face. I had to do something and do it real fast. 5 o'clock supper, it just couldn't last. I yelled out a plan to make witching hour work. Supper in the morning, a big roasted pork. Mom turned to us boys and cackled a phrase. "Come near me, dear children, look into my gaze." We 3 couldn't speak. There was nothing to say. We inched our feet forward, holding hands all the way. She stooped down real low, and she reached out her arms to gobble us up like her own chicken parm. But in her embrace, we found warmth and delight. Wrinkles, wart, wand were gone. It was a beautiful sight. She said, "Supper in the morning? Let's give it a try. You boys are so calm in a bright morning sky." When 8 a.m. came, I raced out of bed. The smell of roast beef, it was lodged in my head. Potatoes and broccoli dripping with butter. Ice cream and brownies, my tummy did flutter. The table was set and the meal was all done. Mom cooked while we slept. She said it was fun. We ate in our PJs and nobody fought. Timmy was yawning while Sam smiled a lot. Mom didn't turn green and she wasn't stressed out. Supper in the morning, it's better, no doubt. When 5 o'clock came, there was nothing to cook. I practiced my piano and Mom read a book. My brothers, they squawked and they screamed oh so loud. So Mom closed her book and she joined in the crowd. She chased them and hugged them and laughed all the while. Witching hour was here. Mom had a smile. Just toast on a napkin for dinner, you see. No dishes to wash. There was nothing to clean. Dad came through the door to a wild scene, and he was surprised that Mom wasn't green. She asked, "How was your day?" She wanted to know. Dad said it was bad because traffic was slow. A meeting went late and he had to miss lunch. He also skipped breakfast to beat the morning rush. "I'm hungry," he said. "My tummy is rumbling. What's for supper? My belly is grumbling." "What's this on a napkin? Is this buttered toast?" "Toast is for breakfast and supper a roast." I called out to Dad and explained the appeal of supper in the morning, the brand new deal. He said, "I'm already at work when supper's at 8, and when it's at 5 o'clock, I'm often late." And then something happened so bad that I froze. My dad grew some fur on his arms and his nose. My ears opened wide, and I started to hear the growl in his tummy sounded just like a bear. His hands grew enormous and changed into paws. At the tips of his paws were gigantic claws. I couldn't believe how my parents could switch to these secret identities, a bear and a witch. I knew that I needed to do something soon. The answer was clear. Let's try supper at noon. I gave that to my husband for his birthday. So gentleness doesn't always prevail, but with the help of the spirit, right? Okay. We want to talk about story, all right? And the soul of our story. Before we get there, I want to tell you a little bit about my story, my journey to faith. I told you a little bit about how I grew up in this little church in Billerica. My nickname was Pat the Brat. Well, 4 years ago, I got a call from this church, okay? Actually, my mom got a call from the woman I told you about. And she said, does your daughter, does Pat still, you know, I know she went to seminary, does she still preach, you know, do all that? And my mom said, yeah, yeah. And she said, we need somebody to fill the pulpit. We're in dire need here. Is she available? So she gave me her number, and we chatted, and I started preaching there twice a month for about 9 months. Then they hired me as their part-time pastor. And I just left that church in May. So that was the church I was raised in. I went back to as a part-time pastor. It was just supposed to be short-term, really to help them find their new pastor. And I was there for 4 years. And it was the biggest blessing for our whole family. So my mom used to go with three little girls, and Rich and I went with our three little boys. You know, same pew, same people. You know, all of my mom's friends. And it was a lot of fun. And sometimes I'd go up to the pulpit and somebody, I don't know who, would leave a picture of me from when I was in middle school. Or in the offering plate, there'd be a sign, you know, when I collect it that'd say, remember Pat the Brat, you know, something like that. So we had fun. We really had fun together. And they have a great pastor now. And, you know, they truly are our family. So I want to tell you a little bit about God's grace in my life, and much of it as it relates to that church. So I grew up in West Billerica on a street called Pequot, and my mom and my dad and my two sisters, Sandy and Karen. Sandy teaches at Gordon College. Margot knows her. And Karen lives in northern Vermont, and she's got 5 kids, and she homeschools them. Wow! And but anyway, so I grew up as the middle child, and I know that explains a lot, right? We had a beloved cat named Mittens. Tom and Sue Cunningham were our neighbors, okay? And I just buried Tom in August, did his funeral, known him my whole life. They lived in the brown cape next door. We were number 5, they were number 7. We lived in a little red ranch. And before I was born, it was my mom and my dad and Sandy with, she has blonde hair, like white as the sand at Singing Beach. And Sue, our neighbor, used to look over the lilac bushes in between our lawns. And Sue said, that little girl needs to know Jesus. Because Sue noticed that the car was always in the driveway on Sunday mornings. But Sue went to this little church in Billerica. So Sue would come over, got to know my mom, and she'd sit down, and they would have coffee together most mornings. And that was just the deal. And Sue invited my mom to church. And my mom went. And, you know, you may think that inviting somebody to church is not a big deal. It's a small thing. But I think of the Cunninghams. I think of Sue and Tom, who is in heaven right now. And I'm so grateful that she looked over the lilac bushes, see this little girl in my mother's arms, and said, they need to know Jesus. I am so grateful that she invited my mother. My mother went. And I think that invitation was God's grace in our lives. I really do. So my mom goes to church, and at this point, she's pregnant with me, baby number two. And she goes into the pastor's study. His name was Dick Hall. And she said, I'm going to have a baby. You know, can we do that thing that we do to children? I just want to sign up for that. How do I do that? Baptism, right? And he said, okay, have a seat. She sat down, and he pulled out of his desk a little pamphlet, the four spiritual laws. You know the track, right? And he opened it up, and number two says, admit you're a sinner. You get the bridge illustration in there, everything. And my mother, it's just the funniest story, said to him, she's got the thickest Boston accent, said, oh no, I'm not a sinner. Just like that. I'm not a sinner. And he said, no, you are, actually. Step number two. And anyway, she became a Christian. So she had been going to the church, she had been hearing the gospel, but then it took the pastor, you know, to sit down, to show her, see this picture, say, no, there's sin that's got to be forgiven. God died for you, forgives you. And she made a confession of faith. It may seem like a small thing, right? I mean, just coming into an office, taking out a little track, going through these steps, but that was a big deal for my family. That invitation to church, those few moments in a pastor's office where he took the time to say, yeah, you're a sinner. I mean, it changed the course of our lives eternally. It's no small thing. It's a big thing. So my mom now has a real faith. She passed that faith on to me. She took us to church. She talked about the gospel. We listened to music. But the first time I took ownership of my faith was in third grade. And I remember it. Third grade in the basement, we had those partitions, you know, those walls that came out, and all metal Sunday school chairs, folding chairs. And Mrs. Beebe was the teacher in third grade, and I was so glad because she was all that you thought a Sunday school teacher should be. She was warm and she was gentle, and we had the flannel board up, and she would change the pictures. And I remember it was a picture of Jesus and the children, and we're all sitting on these chairs, and she asked, would anybody like to invite Jesus to come into their heart? Remember, that's what she asked. And she said, we're going to pray. If you want to do that, raise your hand. So you know what I did? I raised my hand because I wanted Jesus in my heart. And that was the first time that my faith was real to me. And Mrs. Beebe still goes to that church. That may seem like a small thing. Sunday school teacher, that's, you know, raise your hand if you want to ask Christ into your heart. But to me, that wasn't a small thing. That gave me a place in heaven. Relationship with God. And I knew, in a very third grade kind of way, but I knew that God walked with me in my life, that he was with me. So if I was sad, or if I was lonely, or if I felt friendless, and all those things happened, over the years, if I was irritable, I knew God loved me, and I knew he died for me. It was a big deal to me. So my nickname was Pat the Brat. And it was hard to shake that nickname. It's still hard to shake. But I remember going to church and singing in junior choir, and we would put on these musicals. Did you ever do some of the musicals? Do you remember Hark the Herald? Anyone ever do that one? So we did a couple of musicals, and I was so grateful for those experiences, where I got to be around other Christians. My mom knew where I was, my dad knew where I was, and I was influenced by men and women who were older, who I knew were praying for me. There was a group of older women. I don't know how much I talked to them as a little kid, but I know now, because I learned later, that they prayed for Pat the Brat. And one of the women knitted me a stocking for Christmas, and I still hang that up on my mantle every year. Because as she knitted, she prayed. It may seem like a small thing, you know, an older woman praying for a kid who probably doesn't really deserve it, or, but it means a world to me. That made a difference in my life. And I think that was God's grace in my life. So, of course, I went off to college, grew up. Before I was leaving, actually, I was confirmed. I'm Baptist now, sorry, but I was confirmed. And I remember being called up, so I was like 13. And my choir director, she was a deacon. And there were four of us, and she handed us three books. And I still have those books. And I didn't tell her until I left the church in May. I brought them in. I said, you might not remember this, but when I was 13, you called me up in front of the church and you gave everybody these books. She wrote in them. And I used this one a lot as a kid, the Bible Promise book, just clung to promises, you know, when you needed comfort or just looked at those. It may seem like a small thing, you know. Someone asks a deacon, you know, can you go out and pick out a gift for the kids, right? The kids need something, and they get up there. But she was thoughtful, even in choosing her gifts. And they made a difference in my life. I used them, and I kept them. And I think that was God's grace in my life. It wasn't a small thing. I came back to the church to get married in it. And the best decision I've ever made in this life, aside from raising my hand in third grade, married my husband, Rich. He, too, is from Billerica. And standing on that altar and saying yes, committing to one another and committing to, you know, life where we try to honor God. I think God was in that. Because you know, in any relationship, it's not easy. I mean, it is tough. And there are days when you say, is this, are you going to make this? But I think God's been in that, too. I think that's been his grace. Well, the spirit over time, I think, grew within me. Sometimes I ignored it. Sometimes I felt its warmth and it was overwhelming. And now, I sense God's spirit in the everyday little things that I do in life. You know, sometimes you think when you're young, you're gonna go out and you're gonna do these great, big, amazing things for God. Haddon Robinson used to say, it's in the nickels and dimes. It's in the little stuff that we give to God every day. And Alexander McLaren said this, if our likeness to God does not show itself in trifles, what is there left for it to show itself in? For our lives are all made up of trifles. The great things come three or four of them in 70 years, but the little ones, every time the clock ticks. And I know that as a mom, as a woman, trying to work and do this and do that, life is filled with trifles. But I'm thankful for these trifles, and I know that God has given them to me. And I want to honor God, even in the trifles. So even in those small things, whether it's cooking dinner, reading a bedtime story, trying to do the laundry, get to work, get a lecture done, I find God's grace even in that. That He's with me even in that, by my side. God's grace is surprising. And the way He moved me from Pat the Brat to Pastor Pat, who would have guessed? Who would have known? But that's how God works. And He works through all different people in our lives. And they are giving us the gospel, communicating the gospel in all different ways. Peering over that lilac bush, an invitation to church. Look at this track. A few books from some deacons. Someone who's willing to spend the time and practice a bunch of kids, a junior choir. God has been present in it all, every step of my story. And I know that He's at work in your story too. You look back, you see the ways that He has brought you to Him. And you know that He will sustain you till that time comes when you do see Him face to face. God's in your story. So let's talk about our stories. When you think about story in a general sense, stories run on conflict. So think of any show that you like to watch right now. What shows do you watch? I know The Crown, some talk about Downton Abbey. What else do you like to watch?
Superstore.
What is it?
Superstore.
Superstore, okay. All right, I don't know that one. All right, I'm getting a good list. Yes, This Is Us. Yes, that's right. That's PBS too, right? Is that? Yeah. Yeah. But stories run on conflict. So if there's no conflict, there's no story. I mean, nobody's going to read it. Nobody's going to sell it. You're not going to watch it on TV. There's got to be conflict. And conflict you can find at different levels. There's inner conflict, personal conflict, and extra personal conflict. Okay? So inner conflict would be, you know, think of us. My kids are, my youngest is in first grade. You know, what really am I supposed to be doing now? You know, who am I as a mom? Your kids have left the house. Who am I as a woman? You know, what is my place in this world? What do I do as a grandparent? It's this inner conflict. Who am I what does God want me to do with this life? We can have personal conflict. That's two people in conflict, maybe like Euodia and Syntyche. Or maybe you're in conflict with someone in your life. Maybe it's a sibling or a son or a daughter or a daughter-in-law. But there's that conflict. Extra personal conflict, you're talking about really you versus the institution or nature. You're fighting for your child's IEP, okay? Or think of those in the Florida panhandle, right? I mean, truly fighting nature. All these different conflicts. If you think back to our Luke 15 story, think inner conflict. You've got this boy who's looking out over greener pastures, and he's thinking, oh, I want that. Do I want to stay here at home with my dad? No, I want to get out there. You've got personal conflict between the younger brother and his father. You know, they're in conflict with one another. He's in conflict with him. Extra personal conflict. That's a picture of a pig. That's hard to see. But he's up against a famine. And life is hard. So conflict at different levels. Now, I want you to just think about this, just quietly in your own minds. Try to identify where your conflict is right now. You don't have to say it out loud. Inner, personal, or extra personal. I'm guessing you don't have to think too hard about this. You know where it lies. But what is your conflict right now? Is it something you're struggling with internally? Is there just someone you're, you know, at work or, you know, wherever that, ugh. Or is it extra personal? So think and be thinking about that. You're going to love this. A complicated plot deals with one level of conflict. So if you only have one level of conflict, your plot is complicated. But you're complex if your conflict is on two or more levels. Yeah. Your plot is complex. Who's complicated here? I'm definitely complex. I am complex. Stories also have what storytellers or screenwriters would call values. So basically, you get a character in a story who starts one way and ends up another way. It's called a value. So what would be the value in Luke 15? Do you remember the phrase that's repeated over and over again? My son was lost, and now he is. He was dead and is alive. Okay, so that's a value change. And any story has some kind of change. There has to be a transformation in a character. Otherwise, the story doesn't work so well. I'm wondering what your value changes. I mean, if you had to pick a value, what would you say? You know, maybe mine was Pat the Brat to Pastor Pat, or maybe it was foolish to wise. You got lost to found. Could anybody relate with anxious to peaceful? Or maybe angry to joyful, bitter to sweet? That's Naomi's story. Ashamed to accepted, unloved to loved, guilty to forgiven, afraid to confident, mean-spirited to kind, harsh to gentle, insecure to secure, doubting to believing. You could throw in a bunch of them. And I imagine you have one that you say, oh yeah, that one. That's me. That's how I'd describe my value. And that's what the gospel does. The gospel changes us. And if we can identify those values, it really helps us to see who we were and what we are becoming. We're not necessarily there right now, but who we were and what we are becoming. So a story, I'll zoom in a minute. You can understand a story by looking at what we call a story cycle. All right? So every story cycle, it's a circle like this. You've got summer up here. I have to look at it your way. Sorry, summer, fall. Okay. You have summer here, fall, winter, spring, and back to summer. Okay? So in our culture, in Western culture, typically a story begins in summer. Everything's good in summer, right? It's a state of bliss. But if you want people to listen to your story, then summer can't last for very long because it's boring, right? So, did anyone ever watch Law and Order? Okay, so Law and Order. This is how it starts, all right? You've got a man and a woman, and they're just coming out of the movies, and they've had like a first date, and oh, they're so happy, and all of a sudden they trip over a what? Right, yeah, exactly. How do we know that? Okay. So every week, yeah. So they trip over a dead body. So summer was not very long, was it? All of a sudden there's a dead body and they trip over it. And then they're not even in the show the rest of the time. And the dead body is what we call the inciting incident or the inciting event, okay? Something has to happen that throws life out of balance for the protagonist, the main character. Something has to happen. Because you can't live in summer forever. Something happens. Now, we have inciting events in our lives. Absolutely. Something happens that throws life out of balance. They can be good things or they can be bad things. Having a baby throws life out of balance. It does. It just does. And you kind of have to, figure this out all over again. Changing a job throws life out of balance, an inciting event. If someone you love dearly passes away, that throws life out of balance. And you have to regain your equilibrium, right? A loss of a relationship, all of it throws life out of balance. Does that make sense? So we've got that. Summer doesn't last long. We have the inciting event, and that's what pushes you into fall, okay? So the seasons are starting to change. This is the story cycle. It's actually very universal, although some cultures may start in a different place or end in a different place. If we end our story in winter, what kind of story is that called? Yeah, it's a tragedy, yeah. You know, the movies we go see, they always end up back in summer. Or often end up back in summer. So fall, things are getting more difficult and increasingly difficult, and then you keep moving toward winter. Think of Law and Order. You're at winter when you think you got the guy, right? But then you realize he had an alibi, and it's rock solid, and you're back at square one, and somebody burned the evidence, and there's no way you're ever going to solve this crime, right? It is the dead of winter. It's hopeless, okay? Have you ever been in the dead of winter? I mean, we can get there sometimes. You're there and you just think, there is no way out of this. This is a pit. And I don't know, it's not gonna move. And in a story, a movie, a show, a book, there's always a dead of winter. And you think, how is this gonna be solved? How is this person going to get out of this? But then you have something called the surprising twist. The surprising twist occurs in the dead of winter. And that just happens, it almost seems like out of nowhere. And things start to turn around. And then your character begins to move towards spring, things are getting better, and then all the way back to summer, the story is resolved, it's over. But most of the story takes place here, trying to get that conflict resolved. I think it's a good metaphor for life. and you think about it right now. You know, have those values in the back of your mind. But in your story right now, where are you? Are you in summer? Fall? Winter? The dead of winter? Or spring? Is that easy to identify for you? Maybe you've been in a season for a while, or you can think back to a time where it was winter. But that's the story cycle. So I want you to do this. Whenever you watch your favorite show, try to see this pattern at work. Okay? It's there. It'll be fun. And you see this pattern in Scripture. Okay? So I want to play with this just for a minute. Okay, we'll zoom in. So fall contains the scenes that move the plot away from summer. The inciting event propels the story and its characters into fall by throwing life out of balance. Winter is as bad as life can be, and the characters despair that life will never improve. Things really seem hopeless. Spring, loose ends are tied up, and life is getting better and better. And of course, before that, you have the surprising twist that gets things moving towards spring. Summer is a state of bliss. This season never lasts long because the lack of conflict fosters boredom. Not for me. I love summer. Like, get me to summer. That's where I want to live. So that's the inciting incident. It's the event that throws life out of balance. Now the hero is on a journey in pursuit of the object of desire, which will restore balance. So maybe that's you had despair and you're pursuing hope. Somehow, and you know that you know brings you back. But that's how story works in general. Okay? I'm sorry about that. Okay, this is what I want to do. So keeping that story cycle in mind, can we apply it to the grand narrative of the Bible? What would you say is summer in the Bible? Yes. How long does it last? I mean, in the actual Bible, it's not long, yes. Yeah, not long at all. Okay, so in this you can divide in many, yeah, it's the garden. It is the creation and the garden. What is the inciting event that throws life out of balance? Eve, yes. Not just Eve, yes, but she is. Yeah, my husband loves to say, that woman, but yes, so the inciting event, it's sin, right? Sin comes in. And it has thrown life out of balance for all of us for ages, yeah. So fall, things really get worse and worse, don't they, in the Bible. You get to the point in the Judges where it's despicable, really, really bad. You've got some glimmers of hope. You've got some good kings. And then you move to the New Testament. Between the Old and the New Testament is actually a blank page in my Bible. That's 400 years. 400 years in which God did not speak. They didn't hear from him. I mean, that's bad, right? Yeah, yeah, I love that blank page. I just think, wow, nothing was happening there. 400 years. What's winter? I move winter to the New Testament. Not everybody does that. Say you're a follower of Jesus. What's winter for you? Say you're one of the disciples. Yeah, Jesus is crucified, right? It can't get any worse. What's the surprising twist? That's a surprise, right? I mean, that is really a big surprise. Wow. And what's spring?
The church.
Yes, I think it's now. It's the age of the church, yeah. I think we're living in spring. So what is summer? Oh, we're waiting for it, right? And it's coming. It's coming. So that's the story cycle. Okay, does that make sense? Okay. And I want you to be thinking of your, and we'll have a minute to talk about this in groups, but you know, how you might describe your values, where you are in this story, how God has worked in your story, where he's bringing you. Okay, yeah, we just did that. Okay. So this is, you know this story. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. "Look after him," he said, "and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have." So Jesus tells this story. Who is my neighbor, right? He gives them a story. And tell me where Summer is in this story. Let's just practice this, our story cycle. Where is Summer? That's it. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. It's not long. Yeah. And then what's the inciting event? What happens that throws life out of balance for this man? Yeah. He's robbed and beaten. Yeah. They stripped him of his clothes, leaving him half dead. Okay. So we're definitely in fall now, right? And then a priest happened to be going down the same road. So the priest comes first. So Jericho was a town in which priests often resided. Because it wasn't, maybe a half day's journey from Jericho to Jerusalem. So priests were required to serve at the temple a few times every year. They were on rotations. So they'd have to be there for festivals, major festivals, 3 a year. Then they would have this 2-week rotation. So this was the road that they traveled. So there was sort of this changing of the guard. You know, the priests leaving the temple and then the new priests coming in. So we've got this priest, he's going down the same road. Whenever you leave the temple, you're always going down. The Temple Mount is up high, but no matter where you are in the world, you're always going up to the temple. That's how scripture talks about it. So he sees this priest, and let's say he's half dead, but let's say he's got one eye that's a little bit open, okay? It's all shut. And he can tell, you know what a priest looks. He knows this is a priest. What is he thinking? This priest is coming. What is he thinking? Yes, this is my lucky day, right? A priest is coming. But the priest, he passes by on the other side. Wow. Do you think that was a difficult decision for the priest? Do you think he just walked right by, said, "Ooh, half-dead guy, I gotta get home. My wife said I've been away for 2 weeks." What do you think? Nope. No. He probably had to think about it, right? Yeah. I mean, he's coming from his duty at the temple, right? So he probably thought about it, said, I am a priest. Could help this man. But I don't know who he is. What if he's a Gentile? I mean, if I touch him, I have to go back to the temple. That is going to put me behind, I mean, days, right? I've got to weigh this. Is it really in my realm of responsibility? And he's able to justify no. So he passes along on the other side. So for this man with his one eye open, on his story cycle, where is he headed? Yeah, he's headed toward winter. And then who comes next? Levite, yeah. So Levites served in a rotation as well. They did all kinds of things. They were in charge of music. And a Levite would probably follow the priest's lead, okay? So he knows a priest is, you know, a group of priests, maybe just one, whatever. He knows he's before him. And the Levite, he probably stopped and thought about it too, but maybe he reasoned, now I know the priest was before me. He walked by. Well, he could probably walk by too. That's probably what I should do. So he walks by. So, okay, what is the guy with this, you know, eye half open? What is he thinking now? He's going to die. Yeah, it's like the dead of winter now, right? But then a Samaritan comes. So what's the deal with Jews and Samaritans? Do they get along? I mean, it was a truly hatred. It was really a hatred of one another. Jews felt that the Samaritans were not fully Jewish at all. They were transplanted by the Assyrians, and they wouldn't even walk through their region. So here comes a Samaritan as he travels. Now think about this. So the man, he's got this one eye open, sees a Samaritan. Now what is he thinking?
I'm dead.
I'm dead. He's going to finish me off. That's what he's thinking, right? He's going to finish me off. He's a Samaritan. See, you have to get there to understand how surprising this twist is. Because this is not just, okay, another guy from a different region, we speak different dialects or something like this. No, this is a serious enemy who, yeah, I mean, in all likelihood, he's going to not just leave me, but kick me when he walks by. But the surprising twist is he doesn't. He goes right over to the man, he touches him, he helps him, everything that his own people should have been doing. This is what the Samaritan does. And we're led to believe that this whole story gets back to summer, because he says, look after him, and when I return, I'll reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. He's going to come back, he's going to make sure this guy recovers to full health. Okay? So that's applying the story cycle. Go ahead. That's a good question. He believes in God, but he has a different version. So he only takes the first five books of the Bible. He doesn't worship in Jerusalem. He worships in the north. Only follows.
Why was Jesus engaging the Samaritan woman?
Jesus went into that town.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's in the book. That story's in the book. Yes, I write about that story, yeah, in my book. Yeah, she believes in God, but she doesn't have the full picture at all. And she's talking about a Messiah, but she really doesn't have the full picture. Yeah, but Jesus does. He engages her, and she goes and tells everybody else. She's like, you got to come see. Here. What did he tell me?
There was a sermon, and I remember something being said about the Samaritans hating the Jews.
Oh, they both hated each other, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they hated each other.
That's where I got the idea they didn't have their faith.
Yeah. They had a faith, but it was very different, and the Jews looked down on it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah. So that's the story cycle, and you, as you read scripture, try to apply it to different, stories you see. But this is what I want to do now, okay? I want you to just talk for a minute and talk about your values, okay? Where you see, I was this, now I'm this, or I'm becoming this. And talk about where you are in your story cycle right now. Where would you say you are? You know, I'm in summer, everything's peachy, or I'm in the dead of winter, I'm looking for that surprising twist, wondering where it's going to come from. Okay? Could you do that? All right.